Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain.
And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Our guest this week is not only the Tony Award-winning director of Chicago, he has also directed High Fidelity, White Christmas, and Bright Star, and was one of the founding fathers of the celebrated New York City Center Encore series.
But before his incredible directing career, he was one of New York's hardest working actors, appearing in the original Grease, I Love My Wife, and most memorably as Nicely Nicely Johnson in the 1992 revival of Guys and Dolls.
Here to tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Kander and Ebb, Gerald Gutierrez, and Andrea Martin, and how he created his breathtaking turn as Malcolm McBeagle in Love Cycle, a soap operetta.
Oh dear.
Here is Walter Bobby.
Hi, Walter.
Hi.
Thanks
for
joining us.
Thank you so much for being with us today. So I'd like to start there. So what exactly was Love Cycle?
Oh, my God.
You've had this amazing body of work, but I'd like to start there.
Love Cycle, you know, it was supposed to be like a monthly television musical for PBS. And we did the pilot. And what they did is it was like we put together an ensemble cast. Mm-hmm. And like Saturday Night Live, except we were going to do a new original musical every month.
Oh, my gosh.
And the cast was Patti LuPone, Lonnie Price.
Priscilla Lopez, I think,
Priscilla Lopez, me. The first one was just sort of awful. But
never went anywhere.
I played inexplicably a Scottish laundromat attendant. So to this day, whenever I go backstage to see Patti LuPone, they'll say, who may I say is coming, calling? And I'll say, just tell her, it's Hootman McBurger.
So born in Scranton, correct?
Yes.
How'd you get exposed to theater? Parents, friends, school?
No, not at all. I just was drawn to it. I don't know. I was in the kindergarten play. I was, I remember being in the second grade play and I had the biggest part, but I was off stage on a microphone and I hated it. And I thought, this is no good.
I want to be in the footlights.
I want to be out front. So I always just did the school plays and the community theater. I was a business major in college,
right,
and then a literature, and then got my degree in literature and
philosophy.
What
college did you attend?
At the University of Scranton.
At the University of Scranton.
And I thought, who am I kidding? So I then went to graduate school at Catholic University in Washington,
NBC, yeah,
and majored in theater.
Were your parents okay with the switch from?
It was threatening to them. My grandparents were all, Polish immigrant coal miners,
sure,
and they had very, very large families. And it was a very provincial upbringing I had. So the idea of working in the theater was completely foreign to them.
Is that? Yeah.
Actually, I brought my parents their first tickets to a Broadway show that they had ever seen. But I did the school shows and I went to graduate school when I wanted to be in. But they were very much against it. They wouldn't really allow me to do summer stock when I was in college.
Oh, really?
Like that.
Yeah.
I finally did when I was in graduate school. And then I said, I'm just doing this, and I came to New York.
Right after grad school?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was offered some regional theater jobs at Arena and someplace mm-hmm. else. But I really wanted to come to New York, and so I did.
Mm-hmm.
And my family, by then were signed on to the idea that this is what I was going to do. I would come in on the weekends. We lived in New Jersey by then,
mm-hmm.
and I would come to New York and just see five shows a weekend. I'd go to Friday and two on Saturday, and off-Broadway was, there were no Sunday Broadway shows at the time, so I'd go see two off-Broadway shows on Sunday.
Do you remember any of the shows that you saw that?
Well, most memorably, I remember my sister and I coming in and seeing Dames at Sea.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said to my and we laughed. We thought it was hilarious. And I said to my sister naively, I said, when I go to New York, that's the first show I want to do.
And how'd that work out for you?
It did. It's interestingly, I think if you don't know any better, you do things.
Yes.
And I remember I came to New York, and I went to the stage door at the Theatre d'Elysée. It's now the Lucille Lortel, where Dame Cecile was playing. And I knocked on the stage door, and I asked to see the stage manager. And he came out, and I said, hey, this is my picture and resume, and you should call me in and audition me for this show. I said, I could really would be able to do this. And I said, now don't throw my picture in the garbage. I'm telling you, you should bring me in. And lo and behold, they actually did. And I got the job as the last understudy for All the Men in Dame Cecile downtown.
Wow, you were a bold man.
I didn't know I was being bold. I learned everything I know about Josephus from the movies. Goodness. Isn't that the way Donald O'Connor did it?
That's
isn't that the way Gene Kelly did it? You know, you just got off the bus.
Yeah, it's great. It's close to Allentown. Yeah, you
got it. And my fan, what happened was I knew I was going on because I was understudying. One of the people I was understudying was wonderful, Kurt Peterson. Mm. And he knew he had to do a benefit or be somewhere with family. And I knew that in 2 weeks I was going to go on a Sunday. Mm. And so I called my family and I said, would you like to come? I'm going to go on this show. And they said, yes. I said, well, how many tickets do you want? They said, well, let me get back to you. So my family, who was all very sort of dubious about my being in the theater, called back several days later, and I said, how many tickets do you want? They said, 34. I think they had part of the entire neighborhood. They went from being, this is ridiculous, you can't be in show business, you'll end up a drug addict.
Yeah.
And we need 34 seats for
Sunday.
That's great. That's fantastic.
So it's been it's been a wonderful.
Yeah.
Do you remember what your standard audition song was?
Ooh, yes.
Well, talk about presumption. I remember my up-tempo song for a while when I first got off the bus.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yes.
I can't even say it.
Yes.
Will everyone here kindly step to the rear from How Now, Dow Jones?
Yes, of course. Good song,
It's a great song.
It's a great song. I remember singing it for Gower Champion, for Mac and Mabel.
Yes.
I don't know. It just all felt great.
Yeah.
By experience, yes, clearly. Okay. But I when I reflect back, I enjoyed my instincts. They were really kind of corny and wonderful.
Yeah. Besides Dame Cecile, do you remember any other memorable shows, memorable performances that you saw on those trips up to New York?
That I saw?
Yeah.
Oh, so much. My first day in seeing professional theater, I went and saw a matinee of How to Succeed in Business without really trying. And in that evening, I saw a revival of The Glass Menagerie with Maureen Stapleton and Piper Laurie.
Oh
my God, wow.
And I sat there, especially in the afternoon, and I went, I wanted to jump out of my seat, and I thought, I have to come back here and do this. This is what I was in college.
Yeah.
And that's what made it clear to me. I didn't know enough, and I wanted to go to graduate school, but I thought, I'm going to come back here, and this is what I want to do. It's just been all made clear for me that day. And so that's why when I finished graduate school, I really didn't want to go spend a lot of time in regional theater. I always knew I wanted to come to New York and work here, you know.
And you knew that clearly you liked musicals as much as plays. I mean,
I saw
the same.
Everything. I would come in and see, you know, Skyscraper in the afternoon and A View from the Bridge off Broadway.
Amazing.
And
yeah.
You know, I saw everything. And once I saw Maureen Stapleton, I'd come and see anything that Maureen Stapleton was in.
For those of us who never got to see her live on stage, I mean, we know her from films. Mm-hmm. What was it like to see her live and in the flesh?
You couldn't, for me, first of all, she was incredibly charismatic. She was hilarious and sympathetic and strong, and you couldn't catch her acting. You know, it was, I remember her answering the door in, I think it was it Last of the Red Hat Lovers or Plaza
Suite, I think.
And she was answering the door of the hotel room, and she had a piece of roast beef in her hand at the same time, and I thought, this is not direction or anything. It's just like, she was just sublimely hilarious and incredibly heartbreaking. I thought, to me, she was one of the early experiences for me in the theater of the impact you could have on an audience. I just loved her.
Yeah.
Was your graduate school experience, did they appreciate musical theater, or was musical theater something that did not even enter into...
Musical theater was the delight that happened once a year. Well, I remember we had one acting class, and it was interesting. It wasn't a musical theater class, but we had a professor who made us act Gilbert and Sullivan. Not sing the songs, but to take, you know, I am the very model of Major General, and try to do it as a monologue, because it said it doesn't matter if you're singing, it doesn't matter if you... How do you deal with... I am the very model of a modern major general. I have information, animal, vegetable, and mineral as an actor. And although it was there, it was not intentional on his part, it was a wonderful transition for me to understand the importance of interpreting a song or a lyric as dramatic literature and not just a pile of notes that I rested on top of.
That's right.
So
when you direct musicals now, do you ever do that with in any of the rehearsal methods? I mean, taking...
You know, I'll tell you, after we had done years and years of Chicago, I was putting together a national company, and I got together, and it kind of... Everybody was a little freaked at first, but I said, today we're not going to sing the score. We are going to read the script of Chicago as if it was a play. And it was one of the most extraordinary read-throughs I had ever heard. Because everybody knows the songs so well at that point that to get them to say, come on, babe, why don't we paint the town and all that jazz. And we literally read the script as it was a play. The cast was on fire. They responded so dramatically and positively. And then when we went into the rehearsal, they had a different insight into what their task was supposed to be. Because by the time you get to that third and fourth and fifth company, people know the hand gestures and the choreography.
Sure.
And it's hard to get them to open up their souls and their minds and their spirits to what is actually the action of a song or the action of a scene. And I sometimes do that now. I don't think there's a should not be a separation between the two.
Agreed.
Yeah. And I'm more and more drawn to pieces of material where that is true.
Yeah. You know? First Broadway show you were in.
I'm surprised I stayed and survived. My first Broadway show, lasted one night, and it was called Frank Merriwell.
And what was Frank Merriwell about?
Honor Challenge.
Honor Challenge. Yes. Frank Merriwell.
Oh, wow.
You know, sort of you know, it was a turn of the century kind of. There was a villain and a hero, and it was a very kind of corny melodramatic show, musical. And there were wonderful people in that too, and it lasted one night. I think the review in the New York Times was a paragraph. Interestingly, it's the only theater poster I've kept.
Oh, really?
Your Broadway debut.
My Broadway debut.
Of course, you should.
It has one of the best theater posters of that era. It was by what was his name? Tom Bird, who did all those.
Oh yeah, he was
posters,
good.
Volleys, yeah. Godspell. Yeah. Well, he did our poster, and it's actually a magnificent. But it lasted one night. And my first off-Broadway lead was in a show called Drat, which also lasted one night.
What was Drat?
Drat was me and Bonnie Franklin and Jane Connell, and it was The Drunkard. Basically, it was a musical version of The Drunkard. And I had the most remarkable, and I mean, I've been very fortunate, I have to say. The producers came to me 3 days before we opened, and they said, the show is going to close on Sunday, and it's not your fault. And they offered me the standby for the Grass Harp. And I thought, gee, this is either expedient or thoughtful. But I went to rehearsal. I opened the play, which was a dreadful little musical. Mm-hmm. And we closed on Sunday. And on Monday, I went to rehearsal at the Grass Harp and sat there as a musical comedy, you know, maniac.
Yeah.
Suddenly, there I was sitting with Barbara Cook, Karen Mara, you know. Ellis Rabb was directing.
Oh, wow.
Jonathan Tunick was doing his first set of Broadway arrangements. Mm-hmm. So even all along the way, I was always in the most remarkable experiences, even in failure. And the wonderful thing about Frank Merriwell is that Neil Kenyon, who was the director of Dames at Sea, mm-hmm. actually saw me do Dames at Sea before it closed and gave me my first Broadway show. And though it closed in a night, there was something about even when I was in all of these failures, there was some sort of affirmation that I shouldn't stop this.
So it didn't feel like, oh, one after the other.
I felt like Karen Morrow, who opened and closed many shows.
To talk to at some point,
yes.
Definitely.
Oh, she's a
I've always loved her.
Yeah,
always
she's great. Her. And it was they did it also that I could sit there in the theater every night and watch Karen Marlborough and Barbara Cook. That's why the show was ultimately done. Oh. It was just to give me a master class.
High school theater performance. Yeah.
And again, to watch the great Ellis Rabb.
I was just going
to end of
you.
His career. Jeepers creepers, that was good.
What was it like to be directed by him? What
I didn't get to be directed by him. Because
or at least
that
to watch
opened
him.
And we yeah. closed in right. 8 days or something.
What made him so good?
I think... Well, I have to say, I think because he was an actor as well. Mm. And there's so many of us who came to directing, you know, who acted and I think understand the actor's process and understands what the actor needs. And many of the great directors I've worked with, from Jerry Zaks to Dan Sullivan to, you know, Jerry Gutierrez, they acted
yeah.
at some point. Mm-hmm. And for a while, you know, so they really understood the process.
And was Tom Moore the same way on Grease? Was Tom?
Tom, I don't think ever. I think Tom was never an actor. I think Tom was always a director. You know, the thing about Grease is the wonderful lessons I've learned from Pat Birch and Tom Moore on Grease. The lessons I learned as a director was that they celebrated the people they cast. Mm-hmm. There were all these great numbers, but everybody was expected to bring their personality to these roles, which were initially, you could have given anybody's lines to anybody else. They weren't like, oh my God, I think I'll study this, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't that kind of investigation, you know.
Yeah, totally.
You know, so that you could say, did you meet her at the beach? And you could give that line to anybody. So it's like you investigated the text
True.
Carefully right. to find your character. Uh-huh. You had to bring some personality
to right.
it. And of course, they cast 16 very individuated people.
Yeah.
And they just let us be.
Yeah.
You know, they let us exploit...
Must have had a lot of trust in you, you know, as actors.
They either had no trust or they had no choice. But if you look at who they cast originally, they cast a lot of real.
Oh yeah.
And also you're in a musical where there was no chorus. You weren't going to be wearing the same costume as anybody
yeah.
else. You weren't going to be doing the same step at the same yeah. time as anybody else. So. You, as long as you felt comfortable moving, you didn't even, there were no dancers in that show.
Right.
In fact, dancers in that show looked odd because in the original production,
yeah.
you know,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
Over the years, it's morphed into something quite different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Happy Days has informed it and the movie informed it. But originally, we were a rambunctious two gangs who could move well.
Yeah.
And it was exuberant, but it wasn't a tidy piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of Broadway choreography.
And who were you in Grease?
I was Roger, the original mooning champ of
nice.
Rydell High.
Amen.
Congratulations. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
That's very cool. How, so Grease.
I think they called him Potsy or something in the film. They cut his song.
Oh, weird.
How dare they?
How dare they?
Oh, come on.
One of the greatest songs ever written.
Mooning, come on.
I yes. spent my
yes.
day.
Nobody could do it as well as you. That's why it's not in the movie.
That's right.
That's it. That, yeah.
That's the reason.
They didn't want to embarrass themselves.
Tricks.
Oh, my Lord. You know, I was in, I got this show called Tricks. I was in Grease, mm-hmm. and I thought, oh, well, and because I kept getting jobs, I thought, well, this will just happen all the time. I think I'll just do Tricks. Why not? And it had been done in Louisville and Washington at Arena to great acclaim. But when it was brought to New York, it was brought, they changed a lot of the cast.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a first-rate, what's his name? Herman Levin was our producer, who produced My Fair Lady
uh-huh.
and stuff
oh,
like
yeah.
that. Extraordinary cast, Renee Bergeron,
yep.
Joe Morton, on and on. And I thought, oh, I want to do this. And it was kind of a mess. It was unfortunate. Well, it was an adaptation of Scapin, Molière Scapin, and it was called Tricks because it was commedia dell'arte. Mm-hmm. There was lots of business and shtick and stuff, and there was a prop for every line. And I remember saying when we were in rehearsal, and because John had done the show twice before, mm-hmm. it was like he was putting a production and other people's business on top of this Broadway cast. Oh. And we were sort of like rebelled, saying, "Well, what's the heart of the show?
Yeah.
You know." I've done Gilbert and Sullivan as a monologue.
Yeah, exactly.
So what am I doing here exactly, except this business? Yeah. Anyway, it was a troubled piece, and we came to New York. But interestingly, the producers of Grease called me while I was in Detroit because they weren't particularly happy with my replacement.
And you could just leave? You just
We could, you know, I don't know what my contract was, but I had done the show like 9 months or something.
Gotcha.
And I don't know. I probably, you know, when they first had us, they had us, I think, probably on minimum contracts. None of us had any negotiating power. We had done this thing off Broadway. They moved us to Broadway. Right. And on that kind of contract, I bet I could probably have gotten out in a month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And, you know, at that time, you're doing that. You get your next Broadway show, and you get an increase in salary. And anyway, so I'm in Detroit, miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And the producers of Grease call me, and they say, "We hear your show stinks." Perhaps something more elegant, they said, than that. But they said, "Do you want to come back? Because we hear it's not going to run."
Oh.
And we're displeased with the... with your replacement.
Mm-hmm.
I can't forget his name. And I said, yeah. So I opened Tricks at the, now the Neil Simon, then the Alvin Theater.
Yeah.
We ran for 8 performances. I closed.
Yeah.
And I went back into Grease. I was like, I had a guardian angel. I know. People say, well, do you have any tips? I said, mine is not the how-to playbook. I have been... It's been kind of remarkable, yeah. And the same thing happened when I finally went to direct. I just suddenly was directing.
Yeah. You know,
I've been very blessed.
Smothers Brothers.
Oh my God. Yes. Now I needed a job and they called me and they said, "Would you understudy both Smothers Brothers and I Love My Wife?" And I thought, yeah. Why not? What could happen? What are they going to do? Somebody send me to comedy prison? So I one of my friends was in it, Janie Sell, and I had seen it originally with Eileen Graff and James Naughton and a beautiful
Joanna Gleason,
Lenny Baker. And I really thought that Gene Sachs was a remarkable man. I liked him a lot. So I said yes, and I actually went on a lot for Tommy. Dick was fine, but I went on for Tommy a lot. And back in the day, they used to have to do 2 of 3 things. They used to have to do an insert in the program, mm-hmm. change the board out front, mm-hmm. and make an announcement. And they still do. But back then, with the boards out front weren't a regular thing, and they certainly weren't digitized.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody expected Tommy to call in sick. And when they went into the show, Gene had constructed, because it has no overture. It starts with the band playing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On stage, the good times. And so they started the show with Dick coming out stage right, and taking a bow and a spotlight, and me coming out stage left, or Tommy coming out stage left and taking a bow. So I guess the first show I did was a matinee, and you hear at this afternoon's performance, the role ordinarily played by Tom Smothers, be played by Walter Bobbio. Oh, Jesus! Whoa! And I thought, holy mackerel, this is going to be something. So the curtain doesn't go up, and Dick walks out in the spotlight and takes a bow, mm-hmm. and I walk in the spotlight, and I look at the audience like, not my fault. And I bowed, and they laughed, and I had the best time.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And I was on at that point. The first time I was on, I think I was on for a week. And the thing is that Dick, who is... has been spent a career being on stage with a total loose cannon. Mm-hmm. Whatever I did, he was right there with me. He was remarkable.
That's cool.
He never looked disappointed. He never seemed to judge me.
Oh, wow.
And we actually had a very, very good time together. And it was a remarkable experience.
How long were you with the show? Do you remember?
I think they were in the show for about 6 months, and I think they closed the show.
They closed the show.
Well, they didn't close the show, but the show closed while they were in
it.
So did I.
Now, I have to ask, you did a production of She Loves Me?
Yes. Back, you know, Playwrights Horizons used to have the theater, Queen's Theater in the Park at the old World's Fairgrounds.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
And they used to do three shows there a season. And I actually did an under Andre Bishop when he had taken over. And the first show I did at the park was Company. We did the 10th anniversary of Company with the wonderful and prematurely deceased Andre Arnott directing. He was a fantastic director who was lost to us quite early. But the cast was Peter Evans, Christine Baranski, me, oh, wow. Pat Richardson, Mary Testa.
What a cast.
It was amazing. It was the 10th anniversary of Company.
Yeah.
And Jane Galloway, who was sensational, one of the original Vanities. She's no longer in the business. It was remarkable. And then that fall, Jerry Gutierrez was directing She Loves Me, and they asked me to do She Loves Me, which is where I met Andrea Martin.
It is Andrea Martin.
Andrea Martin was in that. She was hilarious. And the late David... my mind.
Carroll?
David Carroll. No. Yes, yes. I did another play with David Carroll, actually, at the Public, Cafe Crown. Yeah. But anyway, again, wonderful people, wonderful cast, great director, and a kind of a remarkable experience. I won't soon forget it. We had a great time.
Just going back a second, who were you in the Company production? Remember who you played?
Sorry, Grateful.
Oh, Harry.
Yeah, Harry. Harry, yeah.
Very
I was
cool.
Sorry, and I was grateful.
You were sorry, and you were grateful.
I did both of those things in a distinctly different way.
Oh.
My sorrow and my gratitude were expressed with remarkable range.
It's that modern major general training.
Layered, really nuanced.
He is
brilliant.
Brilliant
actor.
Yeah.
And then in the 80s, mostly regional theater? Were you on the road a lot or were you in the city a lot?
No, I don't remember doing regional theater. I did a few things. I remember going to the... what's that theater? Maine. Portland Stage Company.
Oh, Portland Stage.
Yeah. Portland Stage Company, and doing a play called Goodbye Freddy by Liz Diggs. Again, with wonderful people.
And Lend Me a Tenor? Did you do Lend Me a Tenor?
Oh, I did the original version of Lend Me a Tenor. Oh, it was called Opera Buffa. We did it at the American Stage Festival.
Oh, my goodness.
The role that rather later and bitterly was handed over to my dear friend Victor Garber.
How dare he.
But up there it was called Opera Buffa, and we thought, this is great. We're going to Broadway. Instead, they took it to London.
Oh.
Oh.
And they did it in London, and they changed the title to Lend Me a Tenor. Mm-hmm. And then it came to America in a dramatic and radically different production, which my dear friend Jerry Zaks didn't cast me in. But although we've worked together multitudes of times. Jerry's a great pal.
Yeah.
But and then they did that in Broadway. But it had a long journey. And when we did it, it was Opera Buffa.
Up From Paradise?
Up From Paradise was one of the most remarkable theater experiences I've had. Stuart Ostro was then running the musical theater lab at the top of the Kennedy Center. And that's where we first did it. Now, is everybody seated? Because this was a musical by Arthur Miller. Arthur Miller Ooh. Took his failed play, The Creation of the World and Other Business, mm-hmm. and turned it into a musical called Up from Paradise, and it was his version of the Genesis story.
Oh.
And Dan Sullivan was directing. Mm-hmm. Adam and Eve were played by Alice Playton and Austin Pendleton. Lonnie Price was Cain. I forget who was Abel. I was Lucifer. Len Cariou was God. It was extraordinary. And it was written for a woodwind quintet.
Oh, my God.
And then we came to New York, and we did it at the Jewish Theater mm-hmm. Company, which I don't know that
Jewish
it exists.
Rep.
Jewish
yeah,
Rep.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And you couldn't get a ticket. The critics just wouldn't give Arthur Miller a break. But it was extraordinary.
Who did the music?
Stanley Silverman. Stanley Silverman, oh, who's written opera, written a lot of film stuff, and was always the creative musical musical guy for the Ontological Hysterical, for Richard Foreman's Ontological Hysterical Theater Company.
That.
But again, there I am in Off from Paradise, and nobody ever heard of, but I'm in the room with this amazing gathering, Arthur Miller.
That's
I'm doing
amazing.
A show with Arthur Miller.
A musical.
Arthur Miller. And there, you know, I'm sitting there with Arthur Miller, who was a great man. I mean, he was just a sensational human. His humanity just poured out of him. He was a large, imposing man. He used to call me Waller.
Waller.
And I remember at one point, and here I am, I'm going, who the hell do you think you are? And I've written my term paper on Arthur Miller as a kid, and now he's standing in the room with me. And I said, Arthur, you know this line I have where I say, enough, enough. Do I have to say it twice? It seems like too much. And he said, did I only type it twice? Say it three times. And I went, oh. So I went, enough, enough. Enough! And he went, see, that's better. And I went, oh, my God. But it was kind of thrilling and presumptuous for me to go up to Arthur Miller with a line note. And then we fixed it. And instead of saying, you idiot, you presumptuous little twit, he just dealt with me seriously and improved it.
That's great.
That's pretty special.
Yeah,
actually.
It was pretty special.
That's great.
I've always actually, that is a show that I actually would like to do again in a small theater.
Oh yeah,
because I think it's kind of a gem. Mm-hmm. That I think is a buried little gem. It's very sweet. It's very pure. And it's a story that we all know, but musically, it's quite surprising.
Oh. Was a recording ever made of that? No. Oh, that's a shame. Mm-hmm. Well, bring it back.
Where you been digging in it? Where have you been?
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
We're
students of the musical theater.
We dig. Guys and Dolls.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, you know, I've known Jerry for a long time. And Jerry and I actually did Grease together because he replaced, he did the National Company, but then he replaced off-Broadway Tim Myers. So I've known Jerry forever. And then, you know, we were hanging out with Chris DeRuyne when he did Sister Mary and his career just changed.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was remarkable, but he was a wonderful New York actor. And I remember I really kind of needed a job. And he called and offered me Anything Goes at Lincoln Center.
Oh.
And I was going through a personal loss in my life. My partner was dying and all that stuff. And I thought, oh, wow, it's so thoughtful. And I did, what's his name? In Anything Goes, the British guy.
Sir Evelyn?
Sir Evelyn,
yeah.
In the Lincoln Center.
At Lincoln Center.
Right. Yeah.
And then Jerry asked me to come into Assassins because Terry Mann had an opening in his contract where he had to be away for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or something to do something at Playwrights Horizons. So Jerry said, would you come in and replace Victor for that, just that period? And I said, well, if you'll put me into it. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly there I was in Assassins for 3 weeks with Deb Monk and Victor Garber and you know, the whole, every place, I keep landing in it. You know what I mean? And they all dealt with me like, come on aboard,
because
that original cast at Playwrights Horizons was remarkable.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Special.
And then when I got the call for Anything Goes, for Guys and Dolls, I said, does Jerry know about this? Because traditionally the show's always been played by a hefty kind of guy.
Right, totally.
And Jerry said, and they said, yeah, Jerry wants to see you. And I said, okay. So I came in, I got ready, I trained, sang my brains out, and he cast me. Then it really wasn't such a slam dunk. It was really, Guys and Dolls was remarkably difficult because Jerry did a lot of things which were fresh and original, like, casting me.
Yeah.
Like, he cast me J.K. Simmons, these two guys, and took the heavy set guy and made him
Stubby K.
And made him what's his name?
Harry the Horse, the gangster guys.
Great way of doing it.
And a lot of the stuff when you go back to the original script, he's always coming in eating a sandwich, carrying a hoagie, all this stuff. And there I was, actually skinny at that time, and walking in with this, food and eating and going to the grocery, and none of it made any sense.
Yeah.
And because there's not really much, talk about a personality role, there's not really much on the page to investigate.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
He walks in and he's the fat guy who sings later on.
Yeah.
Funny.
Got three of the best songs in the show.
Sure. Yeah.
But it is not defined by motivation or any of that stuff. It's just a great part.
Right.
And finally, we were leaving the rehearsal hall, and I remember Jerry saying, would you wear a fat suit? And I said, no, I won't. I said, Jerry, if this doesn't work, it doesn't work, but I can't do that. And I was lost. I think we both were, because I was a friend and whatever. Yeah. And then we came to Broadway, and they changed my costume every day for a week, and then Jerry stopped in some ways directing me or trying to figure it out, and it was the greatest trust act ever.
Mm.
He just left me alone with the audience for about, because Jerry gives notes. And I think we had a really tough conversation, and then there was like 3 days where he just let me figure it out.
Mm.
And I will be forever grateful to him. And we ended up having a remarkable experience. But I had to find a different way in because it wasn't going to be, I wasn't going to be able to define the role by being the sight gag, if you will.
Yeah, totally.
And just by being the guy who looks like that. And I ended up having a great time. But what should have, people say, that'll be just a rolling off a log.
Yeah.
And the Guys and Dolls is tricky because it's such good material unless you do it well,
last
revival proved.
You
can do a bad production of My Fair Lady. So it was great.
What did you discover in those 3 days? I mean, how did you did you just play around? Did you just kind of like try this, try that? No, are they reacting? It was in front of an audience.
I just tapped into what I thought this guy's spirit was.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And his zest and his innocence.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he's the one guy who just... He just likes hanging out with these guys. He probably doesn't even gamble.
No, probably. He just likes being there.
They let him in the club.
Totally.
Did you eventually lose all of the, the apples and the food and all that stuff? Did that go away?
All of that went away.
That all goes away.
I had a bunch of costume changes, and William Ivy Long put me in one suit, And he changed my hat and shoes. And the first time I went on there, he had me in like white shoes and a straw boater. And I thought,
oh,
I felt like Harold Hill. I
thought, yeah.
We got trouble right here. We got trouble right here in Runyonland. And then he changed my hat and my shirt and my shoes every day. And we put together this costume. And I was listening to the audience. And I found the joy in this part.
Mm.
And I don't know. I mean, Jerry and I got through what I think was a tricky moment for both of us.
Yeah. But mutually trusting each other.
We
got you through it. Yeah. And that's beautiful.
Mean, I trust him completely.
This then leads to, I believe, one of your first directing experiences in New York while you're doing Guys and Dolls. Is that right? You did a grand night for singing?
Yes.
How did that come to be? Did you always want to be a director?
Yes.
You always, yeah.
Yeah, but I really couldn't get, as they say, arrested. It's hard to change how people...
You're pigeonholed in our business easily, I think.
And especially if you I've had to change how people perceive me for a long time. Because when you do that many musicals, then people don't call you on for plays.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I went to California for, a while. I did a lot of television.
Yep.
A lot of television drama, and then
Hill
Street Blues,
Thinner.
And L.A. Law, and whatever those shows were.
Yeah,
The Equalizer. I mean, anyways. Suddenly I came back to New York, and I was doing Shaw at Circle in the Square.
Yep,
and I also stopped doing commercials.
Oh,
because there's no way to, because I was very lucky with commercials. I did a lot of commercials, and commercials back in the day were how you could afford to work at Playwrights Horizons, for example,
totally.
Between jobs. But when people see you on camera going, gee, honey, how'd you get it so clean?
Yeah,
And they don't think, yes, we should have him in for that Shaw play.
Yeah.
We're doing Coriolanus.
Yeah,
that's got the guy who did that Cheetos commercial. I the time that I spent in California was really valuable, not just for the way other people perceived me, but for the way I perceived myself.
Yeah, sure.
And then I came back and I did Driving Miss Daisy, and suddenly I was not just doing musicals, but I had to, and I just wouldn't even audition for a musical for 5 years.
Wow.
And
so it was a deliberate effort to,
absolutely, because only you can tell the world what it is you have or interests you or whatever.
And, totally.
And remarkably, it worked, and I got to do a bunch of plays. And then I felt safer going back and doing musicals, and I felt that way as a director, too.
Mm-hmm.
I really, it's like after, after High Fidelity, I just went, I got to get in the sandbox again. I only want to do new plays. I'm going downtown.
Wow.
And I went down with
my,
dear, trusted friend David Ives. And we did three great plays at CSC. I worked at MCC and EST and every alphabet you can think of.
I was amazed at how many off-Broadway theaters you worked at.
Yeah.
I mean, you hit them all.
Manhattan Theater Club and Playwrights Horizons and
Roundabout
CSC. I did, and I just would do new plays. And... And then I thought, I want to do another musical. And so I'm doing one. I think only you can help guide your... You follow
take charge
your,
of it.
Yeah,
take charge of it.
But anyway...
So Grand Night... You obviously have
always Grand Night, here's the thing.
Hammerstein and all of that.
There I am. I'm in a hit Broadway musical in a killer part.
Yep.
And I know that I really want to direct. Because the Rodgers and Hammerstein Estate offered me this 50-minute review at the Rainbow and Stars. It's not like I was an out-of-work actor. Or I didn't know what to do. I was trying to kill some time.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
And I actually went to Jerry Sachs and I said, Jerry, will you give me a 3-week leave of absence to do this? And Jerry, who understood because he transitioned himself, he's been remarkable at so many points in my professional career. Jerry has been for me there as such a loyal friend and colleague. I get choked up every time I talk about him. And Jerry let me out. He gave me a 3-week leave of absence, and I went and took all this material and found a way to rethink it and refresh it and do it not in the ways it was originally contextualized. Yeah. Right. So I wanted to hear wanted to make sure the audience would hear the lyrics again.
Yes, of course.
For some reason, every major New York theater critic came to that review of The Rainbow and Stars. And so all the first string critics were there, and they said, and they went, oh, he can direct. So I went from...
That's amazing.
Yeah. I can whatever, yeah. to like yeah. suddenly I was doing... a Chris Durang play at EST. Suddenly I was doing the first encores. Yep. I was doing a play at Manhattan Theater mm-hmm, Club. Mm-hmm. And then they offered me the artistic directorship. And then what happened is, and then Todd asked me to do an expanded version at the Roundabout, which we did. Anyway... By the time I was offered the first show at Encores, which was Fiorello, mm-hmm. all those people have been saying to me for years, oh, you know, you should direct. Mm-hmm. You should direct. Mm-hmm. Why don't you direct? I called them all. Because I had been working in the middle of town for 25 years, yeah. and suddenly I actually could go from never having directed in New York City to opening up my phone book, and I called Jerry Zaks, and I said to Jay Bender, our casting director, mm-hmm. I said, if Jerry says yes, everybody will come. And Jerry thought about it, and he said yes to playing wow. Fiorello. And then I called Faith Prince and Adam Arkin and Donna McKechnie Phil Bosco.
And they all came.
And I thought to myself, if I could get them to come on and off stage, it's going to be fine.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember the first day of rehearsal, Jerry's watching me. And at the end of the day, he came up to me and he said, it's going to be okay.
Oh, oh my gosh.
Wow.
And it was like, you know.
I get choked up hearing that. I do.
That's a lot. That's
yeah.
amazing.
What a friend. Yeah. What a great group of friends special. Who all came out yeah. for this. Yeah. Were you offered Fiorello or were you told, we'd like to do a show in concert? Do you have any ideas?
No, I was offered Fiorello. The original artistic director of Encores mm-hmm. is... Oh my God! I can't believe we have to tape this. We have to cut this.
Yeah, it's okay.
The original.
Ira Weitzman.
The original artistic director of Encores was Ira Weitzman, mm-hmm. and he put together that first season. Mm-hmm. And I'd known Ira from Playwrights Horizons forever. And Ira actually offered me. Also, you have to remember that Ted Chapin was on the mm-hmm. board, and he had been around the whole. Grand Night for
oh,
Singing
yeah, yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I gave you the permission.
And so suddenly they offered me, and they didn't know what it was going to be, but suddenly there I was at Encores, and you know, John Lee Beatty and Richard Pilbro, yeah. and I called Amazing. William Ivy Long to do yeah. the close, and it was just, I was doing a first rate, I went from nothing to having a huge theater.
It's a testament of relationships too. Yeah, how really important is. Those are, you know, over
yeah,
time.
Yeah, and how people over time yeah. trust them and, you know, yeah. and I've, and the thing I've always remembered is people around me to try to pass that on and help
yeah.
new and emerging people.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Find work.
And you're the template. I mean, Fiorello is pretty much the template of how they're going to proceed to do Encore shows then for the next 20 years or so, right?
Well, I think when they asked me to do... Because the second... When they asked me... Then they asked me to do the next one. I said, no, I spent a long time figuring out Fiorello, mm-hmm. and I don't want to just rush and do any more this season. And then they offered me the artistic directorship. And I said, I will take the artistic directorship. I would be honored to mm-hmm. do it. But we have to have something in the budget for playwrights. We can't go in there and have the actors cutting. We can't have people. We can't have the directors making this cut.
Good for you.
Because the original one, I had called my friend again, John Wideman, because I've known him from Assassins
right,
and Anything Goes.
Yeah.
And I said, John, your dad wrote this. I need to cut it down. Would you please help me? So John edited his own father's book, and I realized when I went into that next season that I wanted real writers. Respectfully dealing with the masters of the American musical theater. So in those first few years, we had everybody from Chris Durang to Terrence McNally to John Guare.
David
I mean, we
Ives.
Just David
yeah.
I, and wow. then David Ives mm-hmm. came along, and then that was just bliss.
Yeah.
But we all, you know, we always had playwrights coming in to edit the work, and then Ives became such a master at it. He did a lot of it after a while. Mm-hmm. But you go over the roster of playwrights who came there to edit encores in those years, and you see that there was, and that I have to take credit for anything that I initiated. I just said it's critical, because the first year I think I was the only one who brought in a playwright mm-hmm. to edit.
Oh, interesting.
And because we didn't quite know what we're doing, you know what I mean? And I think and that was just amazing.
Was Chicago your second season there, or your third season there?
And by the time I got there, I thought, I've got, because here, the first season I put together was season two, and it was Call Me Madam.
Hmm. Oh, fine.
And I was going to direct it. Mm-hmm. And I got closer and closer to it, and I thought, no, I can't direct this. And I fired myself because I realized that all the artistic directors that I really respected around town, people like Andre Bishop and Todd, and Joe Pat, they don't direct. Mm-hmm. Mm. And I thought, I need to focus on identifying what we're doing here and identifying our mission. And it's not about me having a vanity house. It also became important for me, once I started to direct, to go and to appreciate my colleagues and not compete with them.
Totally.
You know, and I remember the first time I met Mark Brokaw at the Young Playwrights Festival. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't in his show, but I sat there and I went, God, this is so well done. Yeah. And one of the first people I hired Out of This World was Mark Brokaw, who really hadn't done musicals, but I thought, he has such great visual imagination. He's going to do a great job.
Yeah.
And my friend Andrea Martin. So I fired myself. And by the time we got to the third season, I thought, I have to give myself a show. And so I gave myself Chicago.
Once again.
Something seems to be working.
Oh my gosh.
What was it like working with Kander and Ebb? Were they involved? I should ask you that.
Nobody knew what encores really quite was. The first encore, the first Fiorello, there was a snowstorm. And for some reason, everybody showed up. They climbed over the snow and they showed up for that first Fiorello. And we went, holy mackerel. Yeah. Because it looked like a party. The cast alone, you couldn't get that cast on Broadway.
Of course. No. It's special. You know? It's an event. It is an event. Yeah.
You know, Marilyn Cooper doing seven lines, you know, every one of them. It was what we call overcast, because mm-hmm. you couldn't really get that company. So it was fantastic. But what was your question?
Were you working with Kander and Ebb on Chicago?
Oh, and what happened when we got to Chicago is that we met with Kander and Ebb, and they just said, well, let us know who's in the cast we'd like to know.
They wanted, okay.
And because we were going to edit it, Fred really wanted me to hire Tommy Thompson. Tommy and Fred were just great.
Yeah.
They loved him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and Tom was like his nephew. Do you know what I mean? They had such a wonderful, it was almost like family. And so I did. And he felt confident knowing that Tommy was overseeing the edit of the script. But other than that, they came to opening night and went, what the hell just happened? They couldn't believe it, because I think, you know, I could never have gone into a Broadway producer's office, even the Weisler's office, mm-hmm. and argued or pitched that production.
Yeah. Sure.
It had to just happen. And then...
Because the original some people might not remember, but the original wasn't exactly a blowout hit when it was originally produced.
It was a very, very different production. It was a subtitle of musical vaudeville, and every scene was done like an homage mm-hmm. to a different vaudeville performer. Mm-hmm. It was a very complex, visionary, but it was a different production.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that we found, when Anne and I got together, I said, I don't want to mount that. What I want to do is I want to honor Fosse and his entire career, mm-hmm. but not revive his. Mm. So we incorporated, originally, you know, Cell Block was done with women running around with holding bars with lights in them and all that stuff. Oh, wow. And I said, I want to do that number like all of his great chair numbers. So let's just have six chairs and interrogation lights above them. It's going to look like it's a Fosse number, but that's not the way they did it originally.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
I remember seeing Pippin, and I'd never seen ladders on the proscenium. So I said, John Lee, can I have a ladder? He said, how about two? And suddenly, instead of being drunk on a piano doing Funny Honey, So there were things from all of Fosse's visual imagination, including how we did the courtroom, that weren't his production, but it was clearly an homage to his style. His taste, you know. And I said to William Ivy Long, I want Fosse's two favorite colors in the show. Black and flesh. And so everything was geared toward honoring his aesthetic, his sensibility, and even his style, as Anne very beautifully did. But without, and now, and I always felt like the three of us directed it. I remember his the late great agent Sam Cohen, who represented Kander and Ebb and Fosse. And Annie and BB and Jimmy. But I remember him saying, you know, if Fosse was alive today, this is probably how he would do it. Wow. Because even by the time he got to the end, by the time he got to, what was it, Big Deal.
Yeah.
He was becoming increasingly a minimalist, increasingly lean in terms of his visual requirements to tell a story.
Mm-hmm. And it's been running now for how many years on Broadway?
19. We're going to celebrate 20 years in September. In November. Musical.
That's right, yeah.
And it is the longest running,
Congratulations. Really, really do you go back to it often?
Oh, I had a full company rehearsal 2 weeks ago. Absolutely. I go back there and I say, you know what? My name's still on the poster. That's Let's get right. to work. And full company. No, I do that several times a year. I go back probably every few weeks. Mm-hmm. I leave notes. We have a great staff. I just had auditions a couple of weeks ago because I'm going to get busy in case we need somebody in the upcoming months. Yeah. I've just seen a whole bunch of people so that I can say, yes, hire him, hire her. No, we're very hands-on. I am very proud of how we maintain that production. I'm never afraid of people going and seeing a 19-year-old show. It doesn't look
that
like
amazing.
It shows,
I saw it.
I mean,
a couple of weeks ago, and it still looks like it opened yesterday. Yeah. It's incredible.
When did you see it? After my rehearsal or before? It was even better after my rehearsal because I went in there and
That's what I heard.
Yes, I did.
Do you ever not tell them you're going to see the show? You know, actors sometimes start acting a little more.
No, always.
Yeah.
Oh, I never. And the house management and the sound guy knows not to say anything. And what happens is, it's the curtain going down. I sneak in and I sit somewhere. And so I always actually see what's going on. And about a month ago, I went in and I saw what was going on, and I was displeased. Mm-hmm. And we addressed it, and it's great. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, that's the first time in years when I felt like I caught them, and it was during the holidays. They had too much cheesecake or something. Yeah. But still, my name's on the poster, and people paid money. They never know I'm there.
That's so you've stuck with. I know your name's on the poster, but you've stuck with this for 19 years. What is it about this story that still appeals to you? Why do you like going back to watch it? Why do you like to go back and give notes beyond?
Well, the thing is. You know, the thing, this is a rare lifetime experience in the theater, to have something run for 19 years. So it's like, dislike, it's like, oh my God, it's a gift. And it's like disrespecting a great gift. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason it keeps running is because it's very, very good material. It's very sturdy material. It is material that lets you completely reinvestigate its nuance, its implications. And the newspaper constantly brings it back to life. I mean, I like about the show is not just its theatricality, the sublime score, which doesn't have one even mediocre song in it. And it is, for me, thematically rich. It's about the manipulation of the press, and it's about getting away with murder. You know, I started the rehearsal last week, and I said, I was talking about, because the judgment had just come down on the guy who has the who had too much money. What is that case? What is it called?
Oh, Affluenza. Oh, the Affluenza
I said, kid. I said, you know, today, Chicago just got reinvigorated.
Yeah.
We have the Affluenza defense.
Yeah.
And that's what Chicago is about. It's about that someone could actually go into a courtroom and say, this child had too much money and therefore he wasn't capable of making good decisions. So he decided to run over four people while he was drunk. I think the judgment of the jury should be, you know. So, mm-hmm. you know, the headlines reinvigorate this theme mm-hmm. on a daily basis or a weekly basis at least.
Yeah.
So I find that it's not just a good story that all of these ideas, it's a story with an ideas, and these ideas are hooked on to a rather compelling storyline
yeah.
and a score that just doesn't stop. And a theatricality. That's why I kind of wanted to strip everything away mm. because I think that you don't need anything to tell for this story to be a rich experience.
It's a great show. That's beautifully constructed. What were some of your other favorite shows that you directed at Encores? I mean, you're so synonymous with Chicago, but there's...
I loved Golden Boy. Mm. I think Golden Boy is one of those scores where every song is a gem. There are no hits in that show.
Nope. Not one hit. No. They're solid.
But good. as it goes along, it is. And I loved what we did with that show. And I actually loved what Wayne Cilento did mm-hmm. with that show. I thought he and I were great for that material, mm-hmm. and he nailed it. And I'm very proud of what we did with Zorba. I thought it was quite remarkable.
It was wonderful.
I was a little irritated, I have to say. By the press response, because I think it's sort of, I think it is kind of a gem,
mm-hmm.
and I thought they were hard on my cast. I felt so lucky when
it was a good cast.
It was a
really I saw good. It, and it was a fabulous cast. Yeah. So I don't know what
and,
their
and
problem
also
is.
I like what's his name? Bradley accused us of trying to do something that was going to move to Broadway. And I think
whoa! That's not what it's about.
No, but the thing is, you know, we had. We had a wall with the orchestra sitting on it.
Yeah.
And everybody had a pair of miner's clothes. The show before had 300 costumes.
Yeah.
And somehow, I don't know whether he thought I was trying to do Chicago again, but I was very angry, and also because I think John Turturro...
Zoe Wanamaker was a revelation.
Santino Fontana. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a sensation.
I saw it twice. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I thought it was great.
I always love going to Encores when they... And in some ways, I feel that way about Zorba. When you see a show that didn't quite work, and you do a good version, so that people can see what it was. I mean, I'm always happy when you go to Encores and you see, things like Juno, and mm-hmm. it's a fantastic Encore.
Yeah.
That was a fantastic.
Yes. That was good.
Great score.
You know, Lost in the Stars, for example.
Oh.
These are shows that can't be revived on Broadway, so that I value when the press and the audience more and more mm-hmm. goes and realizes mm-hmm. they're going to get to see something that's never going to be revived.
Special.
You're going to hear it with a 30-piece orchestra, with the original orchestrations and vocal arrangements. Don't carp about this.
Mm-mm.
Stay home mm-hmm. if you don't want to see it. But these, I think... are precious and rare. Yes, it's wonderful to do No, 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 Net, and that's fun. But it's more remarkable in some ways to do Juno.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to do it so well, or the one my friend, my dear Mark Bruni did last year, Pipe Dream.
Pipe Dream.
Oh, he did
gorgeous.
A remarkable concert
oh,
of Pipe Dream.
Oh, it was gorgeous.
And you go, this show can't be revived, will never be revived. No one's spending $10 million mm-hmm. on it. Go.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I think of Encores as something you just sign on to. I call it the most expensive lecture series in town. It's not about, oh, is it going to move? Should it move?
Yeah,
is it
yeah.
good enough? No, it's not about that. You're going to get to see Pipe Dream. Mm-hmm. Shut up.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks.
No, you were great. Thank you. I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And today on Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, we were speaking to the wonderful Walter Bobby.
Well, oh, I started out being the legendary Walter, did I?
Effervescent.
Walter
anyway,
Bobby. I interrupted your thing.
No, do it again.
Please, no, do it again.
Please,
I'm getting
please.
Out of,
no, I love
I'm
it.
I'm getting out of
no,
your
this
tag.
Is great.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Suf's celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suf's has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.